Morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where you are in the world, and welcome to today's webinar, Microsoft Reveals 10 Key Elements of a Great Agile Team, brought to you by Dr. Dobbs and Microsoft, and broadcast by United Business Media Limited. I'm Eric Bruno, and I'll be your moderator today. We have just a few announcements before we begin. You can participate in the Q&A session by asking questions at any time during this webinar. Just type your question into the Ask a Question text area below the video window and then click the Submit button. At this time, we recommend you disable pop-up blockers. The slides will advance automatically throughout the event. You may also download a copy of the slides by clicking on the Additional Resource button located below the presentation window. If you are experiencing any technical problems, please visit our webinar help guide by clicking on the help link below the presentation window. In addition, you can contact our technical support helpline, which is also located in the webinar help guide. Now on to the presentation, Microsoft reveals 10 key elements of a great agile team. Discussing today's topic is Adam Bjork, Principal Group Program Manager at Microsoft. Aaron is a Principal Program Manager working on the Team Foundation Server Services. He is responsible for work item tracking, reporting, collaboration, and all Agile experiences. Prior to joining Team Foundation Server in 2008, Aaron worked as a software engineer and development lead in Visual Studio. Aaron is passionate about application lifecycle management solutions and has a strong desire to see teams improve their software engineering practices. Now take it away, Aaron.
Great. Thank you, Eric. I appreciate that. And thanks to Dr. Dobbs for inviting me here to present this morning. So again, our topic today is building great agile teams. And what I want to do with today's session is talk to you about 10 things that I think are critical when it comes to putting together agile teams. And I want to move beyond some of the standard things that you might read in agile books. I'm not here to talk today about how to run a great stand-up or how to manage your backlog. Instead, I want to talk about some of the things that we don't often discuss, having to do with motivating our teams, having to deal with dealing with real problems that come up in teams, and together how those things work together to build great agile teams. So before we do that, I want to give you a little bit of an idea of who I am. I always think it's nice to understand who the guy on the other side of the phone is. So again, my name is Aaron Bjork. I'm a program manager, and I work here at Microsoft. I work in the developer division, and my primary area of focus is around agile teams. I work on Team Foundation Server and our service and the Visual Studio products. A little bit about me personally is I'm a Seattle native. I'm one of the few guys at Microsoft that's lived here all my life. I've got three kids and two dogs, and I went to the University of Washington, so I am as local as they come here in the Seattle area. I was actually a business major in college. And two interesting facts about me is I love to play golf. I'm an avid golfer, and I don't know how many of you out there are. I find that there's very few golfers in the software industry. Most of us play golf on the Xbox or some other digital form. I like to play the real form of the game. And another interesting fact is a year ago, my family moved to 15 acres out in the country. So we've gone rural. So I bought a tractor. And I'm doing all kinds of crazy hobby projects on the side. So I write code during the day, and I plow my fields in the evening. All right, so before we jump into the topic, I want to also give you a little bit of background about how we run our teams here within Microsoft. And I'm not speaking about all of Microsoft here. I'm primarily speaking about the developer division and the Visual Studio products. The biggest change that I want to highlight is that over the last few releases, we've dramatically reduced our cycle time. And the slide that you see before you illustrates that. In the Visual Studio 2008 timeframe, we operated on 10 to 12 week coding milestones. What that would include was a team of software developers writing code for, as you can see, 2.5 to 3 months in a period of time before what I would call checking in. And during that time, they would write a lot of code and usually have a celebration at the end of that. Often we called that milestone code complete. And then we would pitch that code over the fence and begin testing it. It worked, obviously, but it also introduces some problems, and I'm going to talk to you today about how we've changed some of those, some of our environment, and how we work through that now. In the Visual Studio 2010 cycle, we reduced that down to 6 weeks. So we went from a 10 to 12 week cycle down to about 6 weeks. And then starting in our last release, the Visual Studio 2012 release, and now the release that we're on today, which is Visual Studio 2013, we operate our entire division on a 3 week cadence. So essentially we have a cycle time of 3 weeks, and every 3 weeks we're writing code, testing that code, and checking it in. Now those 3 week periods are called sprints, and that's what we call them around here. And I want to give you a little bit of an idea of what those look like in a little bit more detail. So we number our sprints. So you can see here that a sprint has a number like 43, 44, 45. We actually are in the final week, or actually we're in the second day of sprint 56 today. So it gives you a little bit of an idea of our numbering. And these are very traditional sprints. So if you're familiar with Scrum, things like that, we operate very similar to that. We do sprint planning at the beginning of our sprints. We complete, we celebrate done at the end of that with sprint ends. One interesting note about our cycle time is that we actually, 5 days after we complete a sprint, we deploy those bits to a working environment. And that working environment today is called Team Foundation Service. So this is a big change from where we've been in the past. And every 3 weeks, we're updating our live service with new bits that we've written in the past 3 weeks. Clearly, this is a big change for where we've been in the past. But this is the way we're doing it now, and it really helps us get working bits into customers' hands and deliver value more quickly to customers. We also do some of the more traditional practices like backlog grooming in the midst of our sprints. And the process repeats. So the reason I wanted to show you that is I wanted to hopefully give you a little bit of an idea that the things that I'm talking about today are actually things that we're putting into practice and things that we practice here internally at Microsoft and within Visual Studio. Okay, so let's jump into the actual presentation. So today I want to talk again about 10 things that I think are critical to building great Agile teams. And you can see the 10 things on your screen here. I'm not going to read them all for you. But let's jump right into the first three and take those as a block. And the first three are what I call autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Now, some of you are probably jumping ahead. And if you are, and have read the book Drive by Dan Pink, you know where I'm going. But Dan Pink, a few years ago, authored a book called Drive, the subtitle being The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. And in that book, Pink contrasted traditional forms of motivation with what he feels is needed to motivate today's workforce. And the traditional forms of motivation that he articulates are what we call the carrot and the stick, which are we can motivate people with rewards. Those are carrots. We can dangle them in front of them and hopefully motivate people with that. We can also reward them with a stick, which is a form of punishment. And we can crack down on our people and drive them really, really hard. Pink's point in the book is that while those forms of motivation worked fairly well in the 20th century, he believes that they're the wrong way to motivate people in today's world and in today's environment. And he works through that in the book. So let me break down each of these terms a little bit more for each of us, because I think what Pink has outlined in Drive relates very, very well to Agile teams and to building great software teams. So the first thing that Pink outlines is autonomy. And he says that all of us have this innate urge to direct our own lives. And I think this is also true when it comes to software. How many people love being told what to do? The answer is very, very few. And we all crave to have the ability to make decisions for ourselves. And I think the exact same thing applies to software teams. Software teams need autonomy. They need some semblance of the ability to make decisions about for themselves about the software that they're working on. Now, I'm not saying that you should give your teams every decision. And, you know, I'm not certainly advocating for not writing specs or doing things like that. But I think we need to find ways within our process, within our cycle time, to make sure that teams have the ability to direct their work and make decisions for themselves. If it's so prescriptive that they're just following a script, I don't think you're going to get the best out of them. The second term here is mastery. And mastery is, as I defined on the screen, just an expert skill, an expert knowledge or outstanding ability. And I think that our software teams need the ability to become masters at what they do. I often see management getting in the way of this, and we do that by changing teams' priorities, by giving them, breaking apart teams, giving them lots of different things to do all at once, and we don't let them get really, really good at something. But again, I think that mastery is super important, and it helps in motivating a team. Let them become masters at what they do. And then finally, it's purpose. Everybody wants to know the why. They want to understand why what they're building is important. And as leaders in our teams and leaders in our organizations, we need to find ways to make sure that we're tying the why of our software back to the team. So they understand the reason that they're putting in long hours or working hard, and why it's important to the business, to our customers, and to those that are ultimately going to be using our software. Now, if you stare at the words that I've got on the left side of the screen, those words are pulled directly from the Agile Manifesto. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the Agile Manifesto. But the manifesto talks about things that we value. Some of those things are individuals, interactions, working software, customer collaboration, and responding to change. And I think when you put those terms side by side with autonomy and purpose, autonomy, mastery, and purpose, excuse me, you see a lot of overlaps. And I think there's a lot of familiarity here. One of the great stories that I love in Pink's book is he outlines two business models for you. And he says, I'm going to tell you a story. He says, I'm going to tell you a story of two separate organizations, both that set out to do the same thing. One of those organizations says that they're going to hire the best and brightest people in the world. They're going to pay them very, very well. They're going to make sure that they're well educated, that they have a great plan, and they have limitless resources really to accomplish their goal. So that's plan A. On the flip side, we've got another organization which says that we're going to hire people for free to work in their spare time just because they want to. And he puts those two, and that we'll call plan B, he puts those two options in front of you and says, which would you choose? And what's interesting about that is that plan A was Microsoft Encarta, and plan B was Wikipedia. Both of these organizations set out to build the greatest online encyclopedia in the world. And Microsoft had a beautiful plan to do that. We had limitless resources, and it didn't work. It failed. Whereas Wikipedia tapped into people's intrinsic need to want to do something. And Wikipedia gave people three things. Wikipedia gave them autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And the result was really outstanding. Here's today's definition of Encarta on Wikipedia. And you'll notice that it starts with Microsoft Encarta was. It's a past tense. And Microsoft discontinued Encarta in 2009 because it was no longer relevant. Wikipedia had won. So to wrap this up, the wrap-up points 1, 2, and 3, autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Somebody told me once that when you think about the people on your teams, you need to think about them in one of two ways. Do you think about them as pieces on a checkerboard in that they're all the same and they're interchangeable and I can move them any which way? Or do you think about them as chess pieces where each of them has some specific moves, something that they're very, very good at? There's clearly some constraints there. But when you get all those pieces working together, you can accomplish something really, really great. So my encouragement to all of you on the call here is to find ways to give your teams autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And if you haven't read Dan Pink's book, I would highly recommend it. Okay, so let's move on to number four. Number four is what I call planning and learning. And I'm going to start with a myth buster. And the myth buster that I'm going to use is that agile teams do in fact plan. I think there's many people still out there in the world that equate agile with no planning, and they think that agile means we're just going to get started and see where it takes us, and there's going to be no discipline or no rigor involved at all with an agile team. I couldn't disagree more, and I hope that you on the call agree with me as well. In fact, I usually argue that agile teams plan more effectively than traditional teams. And I don't mean that as just a statement, but I want to explain to you why. So if you look at the slide in front of you, I've outlined what I see as the return on investment for traditional planning. On our left axis, we have value. And on the x-axis, we have time. And on the y-axis, we have value. The point here is that when you get started planning, you get a high return on investment. So the square on your left-hand side represents the beginning stages of planning. And when you get started planning, you're building on things that you know, and they're tangible, and they're near-term. They're right there in front of you. And you can fairly accurately build good plans on top of them. However, I would argue that the longer that you spend planning, that your return on investment incrementally starts to decrease. And the reason for that is that as you continue planning, you're essentially building on assumptions that you've made earlier. You're building plans on top of plans. And while there can be value in that, I think that you're going to start to see less value over time. And that's why our arc here on the slide starts to flatten out. So how does Agile tell us to plan then, and how is this different? Well, if we take this same graph and we overlay on top of it what I would call Agile planning, we see that Agile teams start in exactly the same way. They start with plans, and this is no different than how a traditional cycle would start. The difference being that with an Agile team, once you've gotten to a certain point, instead of continuing to plan, you're actually going to execute, and you're going to get started building. The reason for this is that Agile tells us that we will actually learn more by getting started than we would by continued planning. So the point here is that an Agile team will plan, execute, and repeat this cycle. And the key here is that what an Agile team does is they actually plan, execute, and then they learn. And that learning is fed directly back into the plans they're making for their next iteration. So the idea here is to maximize our plans, maximize the value that we're getting out of planning. Now, the quote that you see on your screen is from George Patton, a famous Army general here in the U.S., and I love this quote because he said that a good plan violently executed now is better than a perfect plan executed next week. I can tell you without a doubt that our human nature is to study things and plan and plan and plan. I think for some reason we just love to do that. And I think sometimes we need to break out of that cycle and we just need to get started. And I think this quote illustrates that extremely well. I have a slide here now on the screen that I call Planning and Learning. And I'm not going to explain all of this, but this is a little bit of a taste of how we do it inside our teams here working on Visual Studio. We essentially set out with an 18-month vision, and we always have an 18-month vision in mind. So there's planning that goes into putting together that 18-month vision. Then what we do is we break that down into six-month cycles, and every 6 months we're sort of re-updating that plan or taking a fresh look at it. We're applying what we've done over the past 6 months. We're learning from that and adjusting our plan. So the plan doesn't stay static, it becomes much more dynamic. And then every three sprints or every three cycles or three iterations, we have a process where our teams get together to talk about what they're working on and to share what they've been learning over the past three sprints. So you see that essentially what we've done is we've tried to take that planning and learning cycle, and while we apply it at a macro scale, the 18-month vision, we then break it down and repeat that process at much smaller increments. And you can actually apply this all the way down to the team, where each team does backlog grooming, planning, and learning within each sprint as well. So a very common practice that you'll see with Agile teams is to get the team together in the midst of the sprint to talk about what the team's going to be working on in the next sprint. And that particular meeting and that bringing together of the minds on the team is all about planning and learning. It's not a siloed activity for a product owner or for a scrum master or for any other role on your team. It's a team activity where we're going to take all of the learning that the team's been doing and we're going to try to funnel it back into the plans that we're building for our next iteration. And I think that's part of a really, really healthy Agile team. So again, I think what we need to do as leaders, again, as our organization, is make sure that our teams understand how to plan and learn and make sure that they have great channels to learn from. So for example, let's say your team is like mine and they are producing value or producing bits every 3 weeks. That's great. However, if you don't have a chance to learn from that by getting that into customers' hands, whether that's via a demo or actually by deploying something to some environment, you're going to miss out on a learning opportunity. And I think it's critical that we as leaders find and make sure that we have those channels for our teams to plan really well and then to learn really well. Okay, moving on. Number five on my list of things that are critical for Agile teams is what I call fine-tuning and adjusting. Now, I'm going to talk about retrospectives here. I'm not going to make a blanket statement that says do retrospectives, because hopefully if you're on this call and you've studied Agile or done Agile to any length or for any period of time, you understand the value of retrospectives. Instead, though, I want to break down what I think is really, really important in a retrospective and not talk about the process for doing it, but talk about the mindset, if you will, for doing it. So the statement that you see on the screen is the 12th principle on the back page of the Agile Manifesto. Most people are familiar with the front page of the Agile Manifesto, but very few people look at the back page and some of the principles that are involved in it. I love the words with respect to this principle, and they read, at regular intervals, the team reflects on how to become more effective, then tunes and adjusts its behavior accordingly. Now, let me break down these terms a little bit more and add some commentary to go with them. The first thing here is that it tells us that we do this at regular intervals. And, you know, if you're a sort of traditional scrum team or you've gotten in the habit of doing retrospective, this is probably not novel to you. At the end of every iteration, you should be talking about how you can be more effective. And you want it to be regular. You don't want these to be only after you've had a crisis or only after a really good sprint. You want them to be regular, and you want it to be a normal part of the team's routine and a normal part of their process. The next thing that the statement says is that the team talks about how to be more effective. Now, I see a pattern in retrospective that I think is very unhealthy. And that pattern is that we talk about everything that went wrong, but we never talk about how to be more effective. And instead of having a negative conversation around what went wrong, I like to tell teams to have a positive conversation. We don't need to dissect every single thing that went wrong. For the most part, people know why things went wrong. It's good to talk about them, but you need to change the conversation to talking about how can you be more effective? What does it really look like to be more effective? And then from there, you need to tune and adjust your process. And I love the words tune and adjust here because they don't say that we're going to start over. They don't say we're going to create a brand new process for our next sprint. They're very, very specific terms. We're going to fine-tune this thing and we're going to adjust it. And that basically speaks to making very incremental changes. We all know that change is difficult and change can be hard to implement. So start with small changes and look every iteration at how you can become more effective and pick one or two things that you can do differently the next time. Finally, the team here is going to look at tuning and adjusting its own behavior. And another trap I think that we need to be careful of when it comes to our software teams is it's very easy to sit in a retrospective and talk about everything that went wrong outside the team, all the reasons and all the outside influences that caused our team to not have a productive iteration or a productive sprint. While I believe that people need time to vent, and I believe that there is some value in that, you've got to be really, really careful. The purpose of a retrospective is not to identify everyone else's flaws. It's to identify how the team can adjust its behavior. And it's a statement about the team and not about everyone outside the team. So my challenge to you is to make sure that your teams are at regular intervals really looking at how they can be more effective. And I can tell you from personal experience that I've been a part of way too many of what I call big bang retrospectives. And they're retrospectives that happen once in a blue moon at the end of a long product cycle where we spend hours in a room coming up with sticky notes and all kinds of great ideas that we pin on a board or on some piece of butcher paper. And everybody leaves that room anxious and excited about everything great that we've talked about. And usually what we do is we roll those things up and they end up under somebody's desk and none of it gets put into place. What we do is the next day we go back to building software the same way we've always built software. And I think that's very, very broken. So look for ways that your teams can start to fine tune and adjust their process and see if it doesn't help them become more effective. Okay, number six on our list is called play the same game. Now, if we sat down as a group to play any game, whether it's Monopoly or checkers or whatnot, we really need to understand three things about the game. And we need to understand the object of the game, the rules of the game, and how we're keeping score. And this is no different for our software teams. Our teams need to understand what the object of the game that they're playing is and what the rules are and how you're going to keep score for them. The worst thing you can do here is let your teams play different games. And I want to tell you a story here. When we first got started with our Agile transformation here in Visual Studio, we gave teams a lot of autonomy, and we gave them almost too much autonomy over some things. We had some teams doing one-week sprints. We had some teams doing two-week sprints. We had some teams doing four-week sprints. And what this created was just a lot of overhead and a lot of chaos and a lot of process that had to go into trying to manage all of this stuff. How do I manage it all if it's all different, if every team is playing a different game? And what we didn't establish is the basic object, the basic rules, and how we were going to keep score and what was important. And it led to just a lot of project management overhead that really was waste. So my challenge to you is to make sure that your teams are all operating in a similar manner and that they're playing the same game. I'm not going to advocate for a three-week sprint versus a two-week sprint for a one-week sprint. That's for you and your teams to figure out. But I am going to advocate that you choose the same rules and you choose the same length for all your teams, because I think without that, everyone's going to be speaking a different language. That leads us to number seven on my list that I call road rules. And road rules are very, very related to playing the same game. So let me tell you a story here. On a regular basis, I commute into work and I can drive my car down the freeway, and I can drive at a fairly high rate of speed, 60, 65, 70 miles an hour, assuming there's no traffic. And I can do that in my car, which is a large vehicle. And a car, in a lot of ways, is a very dangerous vehicle. It weighs a couple thousand pounds. It can easily injure somebody or kill somebody if not operated in a safe manner. Yet I'm able to take that instrument, that car, and I'm able to drive it at these high rates of speeds just a few feet from people around me. Now, how am I able to do that? Well, I'm able to do that because everybody that's driving on the road with me buys into the rules of the road, and or at least for the most part buys into the rules of the road. And what are those rules? Those rules are things like, you know, if I'm going to change lanes, I'm going to use my turn signal, that there's a safe distance at which I should follow you, that each road that I drive on is going to have a posted speed limit, and it's my job to stay within or close to that posted speed limit. These are rules of the road. And the rules of the road are not actually designed to slow me down. They're designed to keep me safe. They're designed to make sure that the road, which is this instrument from get to point A to point B, that I can maximize my usage of that road and get from point A to point B as quickly and as safely as possible. Now, the reason I use that illustration is that I believe that as leaders and as leaders of software teams, that our job is to do the same thing. We need to provide road rules for our teams. And I think sometimes the word rules gets a little bit of a bad rap. Rules don't have to be a bad thing. In fact, I would argue that rules are designed to help keep your team safe and help them deliver value as quickly and effectively as possible. I've written some things on here that I believe are really important about those road rules. One, that rules are designed to help the team, and that's critical. Again, they're also designed to help keep the team safe. And, you know, thinking back to number six, playing the same game, we've got to have the same set of rules for everyone. Now, I want to issue a warning here, and I want you to be very, very careful. You should not be creating a set of road rules for your team that requires a control room and a massive amount of instrumentation to be effective. If you've done that, you've just created two complex of a process. And I can tell you story after story after story of ways that we've done that internally and failed at it. I often tell the story of our bug form within Visual Studio. And if anybody is from Microsoft on the call, they might be snickering right now because they know exactly where I'm going. In the 2008 timeframe for Visual Studio, we had a bug form that had over 150 fields on it. And you might be wondering, what could you possibly do with 150 fields on a bug form? And the answer is, we didn't know what to do with it, and most people didn't do anything with it. What happened is that we had sort of process overkill or process snowball effect here, and that as teams asked for one additional field or one new thing that they wanted added to the bug form that they can track, we ended up with this massive form that was really serving nobody's needs. And nobody knew how to use it. It was largely inefficient. And at some point, I would actually go in and just fill out random fields just to see if it had any effect. You know, will the sky fall if I change this particular field from that value to that value? And in most cases, the answer was no. So this is an example of where road rules or process got a little bit out of control, and we had to pare that down. I'm proud to say that we have a much smaller number of fields on our bug form. I can't tell you the exact number because I don't have it in front of me. But my point here is that you need to find the right set of rules for your teams that are going to help them drive down that road of delivering value very, very quickly. And I really think you should start with a less is more principle. Start with the bare minimum and add to it as needed. But don't go design a very complex and very intrusive set of road rules. If we did the same thing to our freeways, we could say that we could put a speed bump every 15 feet in order to keep people safe. But all that would really do is annoy the people who are driving on the road and bring traffic to a grinding halt. It wouldn't serve the purpose of the road and of the people that are using the road. So look for the road rules, but be careful that you don't do too much here. Okay, number eight on our list is what I call dealing with debt. Debt is a problem for many software teams. And debt is a problem that for some reason, we always seem to struggle to know how to deal with it. And I think debt can take a lot of different forms. One form is clearly bugs. You can get yourself into bug problems fairly easily when you're building software. If you don't have high quality, if you're not measuring that quality, you can create software with a lot of flaws and a lot of bugs in it. There's also things like technical debt. You can have iterations of work where you write a lot of code, but maybe you don't write tests for that code. You don't write unit tests for it. And you end up with a lot of what I call technical debt hanging around that is dragging the team down. They're trying to move so quickly through their code or through a backlog that they're creating technical debt that they have to drag around with them. Other example are never-ending backlogs that you're just never going to get to the bottom of. Non-functional requirements like performance testing, stress testing. You got to do that stuff. And clearly process, which we talked about on the previous slide. My point here is that as you build your teams, you need to make sure that you understand places where they can create debt problems, and you need to make sure that you have strategies for dealing with this. And you should be dealing with it in every iteration. You shouldn't be pushing this stuff down the road. Because what happens if you push it down the road is you just end up dragging it along behind you, slowing your teams down, and really demotivating them. There's nothing worse that you can do to a team than ask them to stop what they're working on and go pay down a bunch of debt that's been created. Nobody likes that situation. And you've got to find a way to amortize the cost of all this stuff over the lifetime of a project. You've got to find a way to deal with it. The reason I've got the foreclosure picture on the sign is that, you know, this is no different than how we think about house payments and living in a house in America. If you want to own a home, you've got to put down some money and you've got to make payments. And if you get yourself over your head and you take on too much debt, you're going to end up losing that home and you're not going to be able to actually use it or live in it. I think that debt can often lead to this. We set out to build things that look like this. They're beautiful. They look like fun to be a part of, and they're super, super exciting. But if we don't manage the debt that can accumulate as we're building these things, we're going to end up with our cruise ships essentially in dry dock. And a cruise ship in dry dock is the worst place for a ship because it serves no purpose. It belongs in the water. It belongs taking people from point A to point B. But we've got to be careful that we don't let our software projects essentially end up in dry dock, if you will. Okay, moving on to number 9, product owners. This is one of my favorites because I think of myself as a product owner in what I do. And I'm going to contrast two different roles here for you. I'm going to contrast what I call a project manager and a product owner. And a project manager, I think, cares about schedule, and I use the word oversees the team. And I think that's different than a product owner that cares about the product and is a part of a team. Now, if any of you have project manager in your title, I apologize. I'm not trying to offend you. I've worked with tons of great project managers, and I'm not here to bash project managers. But I think building agile teams is about developing a role and a skill set on your team that is the product owner. And a product owner cares about the product and is a part of the team. So you might be staring at these slides and thinking, what's going on with the pig and the chicken next to these words? Well, let me explain. If you've ever heard the story where if you have a pig and a chicken contributing to a ham and eggs breakfast, one of these animals is committed to that breakfast, and one of them is really just participating. The pig is committed. So if a pig wants to participate in a ham and eggs breakfast, it's got to give up its life. That's the only way you're going to get ham, is by a pig giving up its life. Now, a chicken, on the other hand, can contribute to a ham and eggs breakfast by laying an egg. They can contribute by keeping and hanging on to their life. And people often use this example to talk about the illustration between a software team and those outside the software team. So the software team is committed to the project. They're all in. They are pigs, if you will. And they're going to do whatever it takes to build great software. Whereas everybody outside the team is considered a chicken. They can participate, but they can participate from the side. And they don't really have to make a commitment to what the team's embarking on. Many people will tell you that product owners are chickens and that they don't actually participate in the same way that the team does. And I actually fundamentally disagree with that. I think product owners and those, that role on your team, the people that are talking to customers, that are writing specs, that are working with the team to help really understand what it is we're building, they need to be a part of the team, and they need to be pigs in your process, if you will. Don't let them sit on the edges of your team and participate from afar, but make sure that they're central to the team. And I can tell you from experience that that this works, and it works really, really well when you have a product owner really participating in a team. And my final statement here about the 10 things that you need to build great agile teams is you need great environments. And environment here is really a culmination of a lot of what I've already talked about. And I like to contrast two words when I think about environment. I like to ask people what they care more about. Do you care more about having control, or do you care more about building a healthy environment? And clearly the statement that I'm going to make is that we need to give up a little bit of control sometimes to make sure that we're building healthy environments. A statement by Rico Mariana a few years ago said that we want people using our software to fall into the pit of success, meaning that when you're using a piece of software, it's just easy to do the right thing. And if you use an illustration of falling into a pit, where at the bottom of the pit is not a bad thing, but is success, it just becomes easy. Gravity is going to take you there. I think we need to do the same things with our software teams. We need to ensure that the environments that we build for our software teams, and I'm talking about everything here. I'm talking about the way we motivate them, the way we help them plan, the way the road rules that we create, the ways that we help them deal with debt. Is that environment a pit of success? Or is it simply a mountain that they're going to have to climb, a mountain of hurdles and obstacles that are only going to get in their way? And again, I think we've got to be careful that we don't get this stuff backwards. I often put two pictures in front of people, and I said, if you were planting a garden, which environment would you want? Would you want a garden that looked like this or a garden that looked like this? And the answer is obvious. Everybody wants a garden that looks like the one on the left because it looks like it's well-groomed and it's well-watered and it's thought out and there's order here. And it's probably producing a lot more fruit, a lot more value, if you will, than the first garden. And I think that this is our goal as leaders in our organizations is to produce and create environments that allow software teams to produce value and to fall into the pit of success of producing that value. The final point that I'm going to make here is that when you think about your organization, and I've drawn a pyramid to illustrate an organization, I think there's two areas that you can think about in your organization. For the most part, software teams live at the bottom of the organization. And those are the little boxes here at the bottom of our triangle. And up above that, we've got the stratosphere of management or leadership that sit up above the teams. I want to encourage you to focus on this environment. I think oftentimes we build processes, we build road rules, we build plans, we build environments that focus on the top part of this environment. And we really don't understand the environment that our teams work in. My challenge to you is to actually go back to some of your teams today and talk to them about this stuff and ask them about the environment that they work in and ask them if it's healthy. Describe the pit of success and say, what are things that we could be doing as an organization to make sure that the software or the environment that you guys live in, where you build software, where you produce value that we all need, is healthy. How do we do that? And I guarantee you they'll come up with a few things that you're asking them to do that probably aren't contributing to the health of the environment. They're probably just things focused on control that don't add a lot of value. So again, my challenge to you is to take these 10 things and see how they apply to your software teams. I think these are 10 things that are critical to building great agile teams, and I think they're fundamental. if we want great Agile teams, we absolutely have to build an environment where teams will thrive. And we've got to make sure that we're getting the process, and the process that sometimes we desperately want to put in place, we need to make sure that that process is getting out of their way and is actually helping them produce value and helping them build software. So thank you very much for your time today. I hope that you got some value out of the 10 things that that I shared with you and some of the ways that those things have helped our software teams. And I think now I'm going to turn it over to Eric, who's going to facilitate our Q&A time.
Thank you, Aaron. Very informative. Thank you very much. Now, before we begin with today's Q&A, please fill out the feedback form that has opened on your computer. To complete the form, please press the Submit Answer button at the bottom of the page. Thank you in advance for filling out the feedback form. Your participation in this survey allows us to better serve you. And now, on to the question and answer portion. As a reminder, to participate in the Q&A, please type your question into the text box located at the below the media player and then click the Submit Question button. Okay.
Thanks, Eric.
As our first question is, how do you define the object of the game and how to score in the game? An example would be helpful.
Yeah, this is a great question, Chris. So I think you need to sit down with your teams to talk about this. So let me give you an example of what I think the object of the game is. So, again, my teams work on three-week sprints. And our goal at the end of every three-week sprint is to produce something that we can deliver to customers on our service. And so the object of the game, if you will, for our teams is working bits at the end of the sprint. And that is the object of the game. Now, we define some rules along the way, and some of those rules are we're going to keep an eye on bug debt, and we're going to, every week, we're going to evaluate how teams are doing in terms of the debt that they're carrying, and talk to the team if we need to do anything differently. So one of the rules that we've put in place is that if you get above a certain number of bugs during a sprint, you're going to set aside the work that you have been working on, and you're going to go pay down that debt. And that's a rule that we've put in place. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the rule sometimes can get in the way of the object of the game, right? It can sometimes cause a team to not deliver something at the end of the sprint. But the important piece here is that we don't punish the team for then not delivering something at the end of the sprint. We actually encourage them because they've followed the process and they've followed the rule. So when people talk to me about how do we do this, I say sit down with your team. Sit down with some of the key leaders, some of the real folks with their boots on the ground on the team, and ask them, you know, what do you think the object of our game is? How do we think that we should do this? And what are the very, very simple rules that we can put in place that will help our teams deliver more value? So that's the way I'd answer that question.
Thank you, Aaron. Okay, and next question, which is related, is are road rules and game rules the same thing? Aaron?
I think they are. I think road rules and game rules are the same thing. I guess you could make a point that they might be slightly different, but I think in the end, a rule, again, is something that's designed to help keep the team safe and help funnel them into that pit of success. And I think that you could think about them as very much the same thing.
Excellent. Next question. How do you deal with resources being pulled from week one to help with deployment issues? Aaron?
Yeah, it's a good question, Richard. So I think not knowing the intricacies of your team, let me give you sort of how our team thinks about it. So we make sure that we do a fair amount of testing with our operations engineers at the end of our sprints. So in the final week of our sprint, our teams are actually working with our operations team to make sure that we're minimizing risk as we enter deployment, as we enter deployment week. The second thing that we do is that we actually set aside one resource on each team who's sort of on week one going to be available for deployment issues. So in other words, we almost plan for it, and we plan for it in terms of capacity. And we set aside time during that week one because we know inevitably there are going to be some set of issues. So a common way that I would answer this question is don't max out your capacity in every sprint to the point that you're never, you're sort of always coming up, you know, 70% short of your goal. I think you've got to be realistic. And a common number that we use around here when we think about capacity during a sprint is 4 to 5 hours a day. And we say that our folks on our team, our engineers, are going to get 4 to 5 hours a day to actually work on the product. Now, what's happening to those other 3 hours? Well, it might be life-side issues. It might be, meetings and things. I mean, it's just life happens, work happens, and there's other stuff that happens, and you can't plan for all of it. So don't plan for 8 hours a day and then be surprised. I would just set aside some time in week one of your deployment week so that you can be ready for it. And then I guess another thing is, I would just sit down with the team and talk to them about that. Make sure your operations engineers, the guys doing deployments, are talking with your team. And, you know, do some of those things I talked about with regards to a retrospective and look for how we can fine-tune and adjust week to week or sprint to sprint so that we minimize the number of disruptions.
Okay, great answer. Okay, next question. Talking about rules, how do you coexist with rules imposed by models like CMMI, for instance? Aaron?
It's a good question. I think coexisting with CMMI is not a problem. So here's how I think about it. I think of CMMI as there's a set of rules that come with CMMI to illustrate a team's maturity. And that's what CMMI is it's a way to demonstrate maturity. And so you say, in order to demonstrate maturity, I've got to be able to show X, Y, and Z. Now, if you want to achieve CMMI level 3, level 4, level 5, you've got to have evidence of that maturity. And that's what the rules that you're putting in place are designed to do. So I would argue that those rules are sort of contributing to the goal, and the goal is a certain level of maturity that you're trying to demonstrate. I haven't worked with a lot of what I would call super agile CMMI teams, but I actually think that an agile team could demonstrate CMMI maturity very, very easily, because you're producing artifacts along the way that show that you know how to plan, that show that you know how to deal with debt, that show that you know how to deliver value on a regular basis. You can demonstrate that with velocity and things like that. So while if you're trying to be CMMI compliant, CMMI level 3, 4, 5, whatever, you might have more rules, I think the goal here is to get to a less is more approach, and that you've got as few rules as possible in place to help the team still deliver the goal. And again, I'm a less is more guy. I believe in autonomy for teams, and I believe it's really, really important to make sure that the rules, the number of rules and that process isn't stealing all the abilities team to make sort of decisions for themselves. In the end, Agile is about self-governing teams. And if we want to build self-governing teams, we've got to give people a little bit of room to move within the road rules, if you will.
All right, great. Great answer to a difficult question. All right, next question. This one says, I am part of a team working on cutting-edge technology where, number one, we try to find what works and what doesn't, and number two, we have frequently changing requirements. And as a result, we miss deadlines and estimations. Any suggestion on how to plan for this? Aaron?
Yeah, I would say it's a good question. Frequently changing requirements are often viewed as a problem, but it sounds to me like your space is one where it's maybe more expected. So what I would do, I think my approach is to shorten your cycle time. If you've got an environment that you're working in where there's a lot of volatility in the things around you, then I would work in shorter cycles. So you might say, you know what, instead of trying to plan a 3 or 4 week sprint, we're going to work in 1 week sprints, and we're going to plan for a week, we're going to execute, we're going to learn, we're going to plan, execute, and learn. And you might find that over time you can extend that out. Maybe it becomes a 2 week cycle time as you get the team working together and you get more maturity. But I think that's the first thing that I would do is just reduce that cycle time, because if, again, the things outside the team and the requirements, if you will, are changing that much, then the only way you're going to be successful is be able to get that cycle time down. And there's no way you can have a four-week sprint, for example, and have things changing outside the team that are going to impact that. So I think that's where I'd start in that environment.
Okay. Thank you, Aaron. The next question says, our program is suffering from an initial adoption where things are too autonomous. Every team member is doing something wildly different from the others. Can you elaborate what things you find valuable to standardize and what things you feel necessary to leave free? Aaron?
Yeah, it's a good question. Let's see. Let me talk about what things we standardize. So we standardize on the size of our tasks. So most of our teams work with user stories that they break down into tasks. If you look at our teams, they're for the most part Scrum teams. That's how I like to think about them. So task size is one thing that we standardize on. And I'm not saying that every task is going to be 5 hours, but we have a road rule that says we don't want a task to be more than a day's worth of work. It shouldn't be more than 8 hours, for example. I don't want some teams having 2-hour tasks and some teams having 40-hour tasks. There's no way you can measure progress on a 40-hour task across a 3-week sprint. It's just not possible. So we standardize on some things like that, task size. We standardize on working on as few things as possible. So one of the things that you talked about is it sounds like everybody, too much autonomy. Everybody's sort of doing their own thing. And I don't know how big your teams are, but our teams are on the size of 8 to 10 people. And I don't want all 8 or 10 of those people working on something different over the course of a sprint. I want them working on the, maybe 2 or 3 things over the span of that sprint. And that means we're going to pair some people up. We're going to have dev and QA resources pairing up. We might do some pair programming. But we're going to work together towards the same goals. Other things that just come to mind here is we have to make sure that your entire team is participating in planning. If you've really got people sort of all doing different stuff, it sounds like you've just got to start by doing less. And then as you do less, you want to bring the team together so that everybody's contributing. And instead of each person working on something different, you've got more people pairing up or working on things together. So those are maybe some ideas that I have for some of the challenges that you're facing.
Okay, thank you, Aaron. The next question is around technical debt. This one says, everyone sees technical debt differently. Something considered a debt to one person may not be considered a debt to another. How do you suggest we level the playing field in deciding what is and what isn't technical debt? Aaron?
Yeah, great question. So I would get the leaders together in your organization, and I'm not talking about the up high leaders. I'm talking about the folks on the ground in the teams, and I would have that discussion. And I think that's a great example of where you need to have, the same object, the same rules, and you can't all be keeping score on different types of technical debt. And I think quite frankly, sometimes people get a little too religious about how they categorize these things. I would say if we're going to define technical debt as, bugs, we're going to do unit testing and performance testing. Those are the 3 things. And, your 4th thing might not be a part of that list. Let go of it and be okay with starting with a definition that maybe is a little bit different than the one you had wanted. I think we've all got to have a little bit of flexibility in that. And then I would set up time to sort of relook at some of those things. So you want to come back to it, just like we talked about with retrospectives. And maybe every 3 sprints you want to get together and say, is our definition of technical debt still appropriate? Or have we learned anything new? Do we need to add something new that we should be tracking or monitoring because it's getting in the team's way or getting in the way of their ability to produce value? But I would start with a few sort of trusted leaders on the team and get them together for that conversation.
Excellent, Aaron. We have time for one more question with a quick answer. Can you talk about how automated testing plays a role with Agile?
Yeah, I believe automated testing absolutely does play a role. So I want you to be able to automate things within the span of a sprint, and you should be able to automate some of those key workflows through a flow of the product. And we do that on our teams as well. The only caution that I would throw out there is that you got to be careful that you don't automate so much that it becomes difficult to change the project or product. And I've been in this situation where the team knows what the right thing is to do, but they're scared to go change it because if they change it, they're going to have to rewrite a bunch of automated tests. And that's never a good answer. You never want your product owner and the team agreeing that this is the right thing to do, but we're not going to do it because we've sort of over-automated our testing. So I think you've got to strike that balance. I think it's different for every product depending on how UI-driven your product is and how maybe API-driven. There's different automated tests, but I believe that automation definitely plays a role, and you want to be able to have that quick pass or smoke test or whatever you want to call it through the breadth of the product automated so that you can exercise it quickly after every iteration, even maybe every day at the end of each night's build. So I would definitely be in favor of automation. Just be careful not to over-automate.
Great. Thank you, Aaron. And that's pretty much all the time we have for questions. For more information related to today's webinar, please visit any of the resource links open before you. Within the next 24 to 48 hours, you will receive a personalized follow-up email with details and a link to today's presentation on demand. Additionally, you can view today's event on demand by visiting one of the URLs you see in front of you here. Thank you for attending today's webinar, Microsoft Reveals 10 Key Elements of a Great Agile Team, brought to you by Dr. Dobbs and Microsoft. This webinar is copyright 2013 by United Business Media, LLC. The presentation materials are owned by or copyrighted, if that is the case, by Dr. Dobbs and Microsoft, who are solely responsible for its content, and the individual speakers are solely responsible for their content and their opinions. On behalf of our guests, Aaron Bjork, I'm Eric Bruno, and thank you for your time today, and have a great day.